You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. Stuart Goldsmith here, and I apologise for the delay. I'm sorry I've left you alone for an extra week. I've been working on my Edinburgh show. It's July, things have been getting mental. Let's go straight into a chat with Alan Cochran, who is one of my best friends in comedy, and I'm very proud to call him that. He's just an absolutely riveting performer, and like so many great comics, maybe doesn't have quite the recognition that his talent and his craft and his massive ability really deserve. So here is Alan Cochran. Let me tell you, why don't we start by me telling you about my shit day?
Okay.
Because normally, I've made notes of things that I'd like to talk to you about, and one of the things you're great at is talking me out of having had a shit gig. I've many fond memories of having had a horrible gig and having told you about it, and you being very good at helping me through that.
Well, I think it's good to have someone to do that with, definitely. And I think, you know, loads of it is just getting over that and onto the next one, isn't it? It's much easier if your next gig is the next day, I think.
Yeah.
That's why it's sort of... But what exactly can I help you with
on your
podcast?
I'll tell you.
Is it meant to be all about you?
Yeah, it is. It starts off being all about me. I feel that's a good way to relax myself, as if it's all about me for a bit. I did a gig last night and I died horribly.
Yeah.
And it was an hour of silence. And as I was saying before, I've recorded 12 minutes of my reaction to it afterwards for future release.
But you also told me that you've recorded the actual gig.
Yes.
And I think... I sometimes worry about the wisdom of recording gigs, but on really bad ones, I think there's sometimes a benefit to listening back to it, because almost always when you listen back to it, it's slightly better than your recall of it is, because during it you're doing the Death of a Thousand Cuts thing and they're all digging in. But you told me you got 4 laughs, and I bet if you
in an hour, Alan.
Yeah, but I bet if you listened to it, you would have got like 20 laughs and 8 titters or whatever. You slightly pollute it by the fact you're feeling terrible, then your memory of it. And similarly, I think listening to gigs where you think you've stormed and you go, this is just full of half laughs all the way through. I'm an idiot that my ego just completely got in
the
way.
That is absolutely the case. I'm forever doing that. I'm forever listening back to ones that I thought were amazing.
Yeah.
And it's just my ego. We got onto this because my voice sounds weird, because my voice hasn't dropped back down into my body and I'm just noticing it
again.
Because
you've been sobbing since...
I've not been sobbing. I have sobbed. I've sobbed in front of you in the past. God.
I think it'll probably be okay.
It will. No, it will. Well, it was an unusual
gig.
Try
and think of a minute within that gig that you actually thought, oh, this is it. Like, look for one good thing in it, find it, and then get rid of it.
And
in
then
your
move
head.
On.
Just literally look for the one good bit that you did last night, that you liked how it went, and then get rid of the whole of the rest.
Yeah. I think the best bit that happened was at one point... That someone in the audience accused me of having a go at the audience, and I said, yes, if you can call yourself that.
Excellent.
I was quite pleased with that. It didn't get a laugh.
Ditch the rest of your house. That's funny. That's fine. I think you can do that. We've talked about Lombardi before, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Tell us about Lombardi. Oh,
Lombardi's the sports coach, and when he became coach of, I think it was the Green Bay Packers that he was like the most successful with, and he apparently stopped them watching videos of plays that they hadn't done well in. Mm-hmm. They only watched the successful ones. So you can sort of see how that would have an impact. If you only ever see yourself doing a thing well, that's sort of how you visualise it in your head and think about it, which is why I think it's worth looking for the good in a bad gig.
Yeah.
And also I think, you know, sensibly looking for the bad in a good gig is probably, but they don't do that. Sports people aren't trying to be balanced, are they? They're trying to be awesome.
Balanced. Okay. What? I was halfway through formulating a thing, and then that reminded me of a thing. And don't worry, I'll cut out all my shit as well.
Okay.
Sportsmen aren't trying to be balanced. Do you think you're balanced as a comedian? Like, do you think the job of comedy is to be? I tell you what. Here's a thing, Alan. Yeah. I know something that winds you up.
Yeah.
Is when comedians are constantly affirmative towards their audience.
Yeah.
And they tell the audience how great it's going.
Yeah.
That to me seems like an example of something without balance.
Yeah.
Are you in a similar thing?
Well, I think what it is if they're that affirmative and not particularly interesting, if you tell them, hey guys, you're a great crowd, but all you ever say is stuff that's resolutely unchallenging, well, of course they're a great crowd, because it's fucking easy for them to be a great crowd, because you're the most sugary, boring shit they've ever seen. But really, what you ought to be saying is, here's something that you might not like, but you're a great crowd.
Yeah.
And give them the horror show stuff. Not that I'm suggesting that it has to be that way for comedy, but yeah, I do find sometimes people are... I think the real bugbear that I have is a falseness in comedy, and there are a series of tricks that you can do to make audiences like you or go with you, or to almost channel them in that way that it's like funnel sales pitches, isn't it, where all the answers they give lead to them buying the fucking toilet brush or whatever it is. And I think there's ways of doing that with stand-up of, hey, you guys are a great crowd, I don't normally tell this bit to audiences, but you guys have been so great.
Yeah.
Here's my shitty stuff about ginger people.
Yeah.
Do fuck off. You know what I mean? So yeah, I may have grumbled to you about acts being falsely affirmative in the past, but that's because I think, don't cheat. It's such an interesting thing to try and do well. What's the point in cheating? Because then you just become a shit act. Like, just try and be good at it.
So we're going to be hearing a lot from Alan today. A fascinating critique that he has of the culture in stand-up, of telling your audience how great they are. That's very interesting. That's a lot of fun. This is really... all of Alan's work is a masterclass in quality control and indeed texture in finding jokes from... I was going to say finding jokes where you wouldn't expect to find them, and that's certainly true, but also finding humour from the... There's finding humour in subtlety. That's what Alan's really good at. His work is fascinating. I really urge you to check him out. Apologies, there is a building site in the background. There will be occasional violent lurches in the background, and at one point, literally, a dude hitting a bit of metal with a hammer. Alan is very on the ball regarding... Oh, no, I've done something awful. I was going to say he's on the ball regarding sporting metaphors, but that wasn't a deliberate awful pun. But he's got some really interesting ideas about adapting sporting, motivational training kind of aphorisms to coping with life as a comedian. We're going to talk about the comedy industry and its existence or not. And there's lots and lots of really good technical stuff about how Alan develops a routine. So I think you're really going to enjoy that. There is some extra content for this one. We've got about 25, half an hour of extra stuff that you can download for free. So listen out. out at the end. Hello to David Whitney. That's the other little admin thing I've got to do. It was David who asked the question I referred to in last week's show about tax deductions for tubby comedians. His words. The next one, which is going to be Liam Malone, finally, has been a bit of a backlog. Liam Malone's podcast, that is going to come out during the Edinburgh Festival, with luck, if I can get it together whilst also finalising the details of my Edinburgh show. I'm just going to plug Liam's show very quickly here. It's called A Land Fit for Fuckwits. Have a look at that on edfringe.com. He is a genuinely talented writer with a real skill and a penchant for saying the unsayable. He's very, very exciting. So look out for that. That's Liam Malone. And on the subject of tickets for Edinburgh, needless to say, tickets for Prick, my own solo show, are also available. That's 7:30 p.m. in the Pleasance Courtyard every night, apart from the 15th. There might have been a delay to this podcast, but as a result, Prick is looking very shiny indeed. I'm not bound under the terms of the bargain. I can do as many puns as I like. And of course, the live version of The Comedian's Comedian is at 12:15 lunchtime, Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays at the Gilded Balloon throughout the Fringe. Here at last, for those of you that haven't seen it on the website, is the full list of who I'm going to be talking to. Very excited about these. Friday the 3rd, Saturday 4th and Sunday 5th, we've got Sarah Pascoe, Fred McCauley and Josh Widdicombe. Friday the 10th is Alan Davies. Saturday the 11th is the boy with tape on his face. That's going to be really interesting. And I don't know that I've ever heard Sam talk about how he makes his work, which, of course, is all silent. Sunday the 12th, a Banderman, so some hip-hop rappers. Rob Broderick seems to be terribly worried about the forthcoming chat and worrying that he's not going to have much to say. He could not be more wrong. That's going to be brilliant. Friday the 17th, the wonderful Pappies. Saturday the 18th, Hannibal Buress. I've recently downloaded his latest album, Animal Furnace. Just fantastic, again. Sunday the 19th, the glorious Eddie Pepitone. His Eddie Pepitone and Alan Davies and Rod's shows are all selling very, very quickly, so jump on that fast. Friday the 24th is Rod. Saturday the 25th is Terry Alderton, superb Terry Alderton. And Sunday the 26th, the final show, we have a mystery guest. So, yes, Eddie, Alan and Rod all selling very quickly. But I think some of my less well-known guests as well are people whose acts I know in some depth, people I've worked with for a long time. So I think we can look forward to some really penetrating, wrong word, interesting conversations. So that's enough guff, as I'm fond of saying. Pin back your lug holes and enjoy the rest of my chat with Alan Cochran.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You've got very high standards. You're, I think, in your own material as well, you're very, very critical of right. your own material. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, times.
Like, you don't let yourself get away with things. I'll tell you what, another way of putting it, you've got really good quality control.
Right. Well, that's nice. I have constant doubts about that. I think I'm a much more natural performer than writer. And I sort of performed a lot at school, and I've gone into stand-up. But I've always been really drawn to funny people and funniness, like funny bones. I've loved comedy since I was a kid, but really, I kind of think I probably try and work on my material because that's, if anything, my naturally weaker arm. But I actually think sometimes, like if I've got a TV gig coming up and they say, "Oh, what stuff are you going to do?" I can easily look at my stuff and think, "There are no jokes in this. This is all mm-hmm. shit." And weirdly, there's various points in my turnover. Like if I have a new bit that's working, it tends to work for a little while I'm excited about it, and the performing version of me can kind of get by on a bit of dimples and charisma and going, hey, this is a thought I had on a train the other day, isn't this stupid? Mm-hmm. But then there's a point after that where I'm not as in love with the new idea, and then it actually has to have good jokes in it, otherwise I have to drop it because the audience are just looking going, well, this is just a thing you thought on a train, what's the punchline? And really that's sort of that becomes a second wave where I need to add actual gaggy surprises in it.
Okay.
And that's when my stuff gets quite strong, I think, when I actually go, oh, okay, well, you've had the initial idea and now you're over the sort of, ooh, what about this? And then you go, now it needs what I think of as punchlines, but often don't really look like them. But you know what I mean.
Is that reflected in how you, in like the life of a bit? Say you're seeing a bloke eating a peach on a train bit.
Yeah.
Which is something that you are known for. Like, and I think it's, you're known for it as well. I think it's kind of a signature bit because it's such a tiny, tiny little observation.
Uh-huh.
Such a mundane thing that most people wouldn't even notice.
Right.
Really kind of like with completely unpacked as a subject. And I think that's very you.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a lot more likely to do, or that seems to resonate with what I think of as Alan Cochran.
Yeah.
More than, say, a bit about cats and dogs.
Well, that bit in particular, I mean, all right, let's use that as an example of my stand-up process, if you like. That bit started as a text message. Because I was sitting opposite a man who ate a peach and drank a full can of Red Bull in three gulps, and I texted my wife, who does this? What kind of guy is, like, what's his diet like? You know, sort of, you know, stupid banter back and forth. What kind of shits does he do? You know? And then I mentioned it to somebody else and they said, what kind of day is he expecting? And I thought, well, that's a funny line on top of it. And so that ended up in the routine. And then it just gradually became that I was talking about peaches and Red Bull. But then there was a point where it went from okay to being sort of actually exciting to do. And that point was where one night I was doing it and I somehow mentioned I rarely eat a peach anywhere but standing over my own kitchen sink with peach juice running down my chin, and that, unbeknown to me, got like this massive resonating
that
feeling.
Chimed with everyone, didn't it?
Who would have thought, though? Yeah. But I didn't do it on purpose. I was just talking about peaches and it came out, and so then that became part of the routine. And then for a little while there was a bit where I talked about the first time in your life you see another person eat an apple core.
Oh, yeah, okay,
and,
yeah.
And as a kid you go, what the rules have changed. I thought you were meant to leave that bit. You know, what are you going to eat next? Your shoe? The clock? Yeah. You know. And I think there was also some jokes in there about somebody eating the skin of a pineapple. I can't really remember all of them, but that's pretty much the evolution of my stuff. It will start as a thought on a train or in life, and then there will be some added jokes to it, and then there will be a sort of a tipping point, which was about the point I was talking about pineapples and apple mm-hmm. cores, and then it sort of shrinks back to the basic
okay.
stuff.
And at what point are you at the writing desk during that, or are you? Is that just like you see the thing, you have the funny idea, and then you go on stage and sort of loosely talk around it in a new material gig, or
possibly,
slip it between
yeah.
two good bits on a Saturday night? Or?
Well, no, I've never been that good at stand-up that I slip it between two good bits, or I look at my set list and think, oh, where's a place for this? That peach on a train thing I probably did that night that mm-hmm. I'd seen, probably at the very start of whatever gig I was doing. I probably went, I was on the train today, saw a man eat a peach and drink a full can of Red Bull, and I never really, I'm trying to get more controlled now because I used to die. I used to die more frequently. And sometimes when I was younger, I can't believe this, but like I would be doing 10 minutes on the boat or something, and they'd say, oh, there's important people in, and I'd do whatever stuff I'd come up with that weekend and not realise that, you know. So I'm a bit more controlling now. But
that's quite a good place to do it at the top of a set, though, because that kind of draws on your kind of comparing gears
to
be able to improvise it in that kind of... You know, you haven't done a really solid punchline before it, so it's got nothing to look bad against.
Yeah, true enough. But one of the best bits of advice at stand-up that I was given when I was sort of starting, and it's especially good for new compares, I think, is don't forget to be funny at the start.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so easy as a new comp, like say you've got a functioning 20, it's so easy to go on and dick about with the front row, not really make any offers of anything that's properly funny in your mind, and then wonder why they're not laughing. And you think, be funny at the start and then dick about a little bit and let them know that you've made an offer. Even if they don't find it funny, at least you've made an offer. So then you can kind of judge them as like, oh, well, they didn't really like that train joke that I did right at the top, so this lot might be a bit tough. But if you haven't done it and you're just thinking this lot might be a bit tough, you need to try jokes on them.
Yeah, because then you can easily get into the groove of the compare, seeing the compare go on, not really be that funny, and then start having a go at them for not having much energy. This is a weird crowd. Well, what's wrong with you? You
know? It's particularly easy to do if you've got one big bit that you really love that you're holding back for after the interval. And so you sort of... And it's really easy to do, but actually I think making offers as early as possible is not a bad thing. So I would try and guard against going on and going, oh, this happened to me on the train today. I should say it's not all about trains, but... that bit, I think I was doing an Edinburgh Festival show and really wanted it all to be dense with jokes. So even though it's a story, there should be surprises every second line kind of thing. So, putting in the thing about eating it over the sink and kitchen roll, and then I think there might have even been a wanking joke, and just continually putting in a new image so that in the audience's head they're seeing this gallery of funny pictures one after the other.
Okay.
And I would actively at one point have sat down with a pen and paper, probably listening back to a recording of a preview the night before. I know, because we moved house to Manchester and I was especially focused on, I really need my stuff to be as funny as it can be this year. And so I used to record gigs and sit and, you know, sometimes you might have a drive back after a preview or something, and I would sit in that kitchen with maybe a glass of wine and a pad and a pen and just listen to the preview that I'd done and almost listen to it slightly combatively, thinking all the way through it, you could have said something else funnier there.
Yeah.
Like, and just each thing thinking, is there something else that I can say on top of that that's a bit funnier than that? And it just grows routines.
This idea of...
It's quite tough love.
But. Yeah, well, that's it. That's what I mean. Quality control, tough love. This idea of a gallery of funny pictures. Tell me about that. I've never heard anyone describe it as that before.
I just think, especially if you're telling a story, it's really easy to just tell a story that only has one picture in it. You saw a man eat a peach on a train. But, you know, if you're deft enough with language, you can go from that to seeing a person eat an apple core to seeing a person eat a broken up clock or something, you know, like you're sort of trying to switch the pictures, like not quite like a cartoon, but you know, I just think it's worth suggesting new ideas for them all the time so that you get jokes on the way to other jokes.
Yeah, this is something I know you're a fan, as am I, of Seinfeld.
Yes.
And the way I think we've talked in the past about his about how his routine is like every line is a different angle on a subject.
Yeah.
That's a similar sort of thing, isn't it? So the tags are, rather than just being another funny version of what the punchline was,
his
tags are a whole new angle, a whole new, like looking at that thing from 270 degrees and north. You know, and looking at it somewhere
else. And it's, in a way, it's I really admire one-liner comics, but I can't do it because I want to wring the idea out for longer. So if I came up with like a really good crisp one-liner, I'd sort of then want to talk about the next thought after it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't suit me, but in a way the amount of comic invention is near enough the same. Like if you look at Stephen Wright's 3 minutes and look at Seinfeld's 3 minutes, there's probably the same number of ideas in it. It's just that Seinfeld's pretending they're all about horses or whatever.
Yeah.
But actually he's just chucking in different jokes that are kind of about horses. But that it's also one of my slight bugbears that, you know, one-liner comics or surreal comics are given credit for invention and imagination, that if you're talking about pizza slicing you don't really get because it's all banal. But I'm quite drawn to the theatre of the banal. I quite like talking about life. It's fine, isn't it? Isn't it? Please tell me it's fine.
We were talking about being funny straight away, not forgetting to be funny immediately.
Yeah.
It reminded me of the first time I did The Creek, or among the first times I did Up the Creek in Greenwich / Deptford.
Uh-huh.
And I remember you, I remember very clearly, because you're someone that's given me a lot of advice over the years.
Yeah, I shudder about that.
Both solicited and unsolicited.
I'm not sure there's been that much unsolicited. I don't think... I'm not one of those guys, I hope.
No, you're not. And we know each other very well. I'm not, you know what I mean? It's not like you go around handing out advice.
We knew each other before you did stand up.
Exactly.
So that's slightly different. But I wouldn't be one of those guys at the comedy store that an open spot comes off and says, okay, here's three things that you can do.
Yeah, no. But that thing about, I mean, that's another thing again, of being, like, because you were friends with me and a comedian before I became a comedian, I can never be in your year at school.
Yeah.
You'll always be a sixth former. Like, even if I were, God forbid, to suddenly have an incredibly glittering career and overtake you financially or something, maybe book a suite at the Radisson. But even
on
then...
last minute, by the way.
And we'll go back to that tip as well, because it's a good tip. But even then, I'd know that you still outranked me. You were still a sixth former.
Yeah.
Because you were going first.
But sadly, one of the saddest things about show business is that there's no queue. There is no queue, and the thing that is distressing for people like myself that are quite happy in a queue is that natural queue jumpers thrive in show business.
There is no queue. I'm very keen on this idea. There's no queue, and there's also no industry.
There's
no industry. There's just a bunch of individuals trying to make a thing happen.
Some people are working hard. There must be some industry.
But what I mean is, I think it's. Let's talk about the queue then. The illusion of the queue. It does feel like there's a pathway. When you start, you are not paid, and you only do fives. Then you do sevens. Then you do tens. Then 15s. Then 20s. And then you're starting to get paid, hopefully, by then. And then the money goes up and you start feeling like there's a path in front of you. You start feeling like there's a queue.
Yeah. But as I've pointed out to you on many occasions, I'm the invisible man of comedy. If we talk about comedy school years, like my comedy school year, nobody seemed to notice that I was going from open spot to paid 10 to... There was paid 10s then. There aren't now, are there? To 20s and then... I was getting booked by the clubs and started doing like bits of TV warm up and did an Edinburgh show that was nominated for newcomer and got, I think, 5 stars in the list in the first week or the second week. And it was all exciting. But that was probably the only time that people really noticed was my first Edinburgh show. And since then, it's kind of been an exercise in just getting on with it and trying for it to be as good as it can be, because people noticing and getting excited isn't the end point, is it? It's for me to be a good stand-up. That's the point for me. You know, it'd be great if people started chucking money and opportunity at me, but in the absence of that, being a good stand-up is the thing. And in a weird way, I think it's sort of what we're all chasing, isn't it? Whether you're playing arenas or... you know, up the creek, I think people are trying to be good stand-ups. So I try and convince myself not to worry too much about the industry that you tell me doesn't exist.
Well, this is it. This is a conversation that we've had sort of back and forth a lot. And who I wonder, because I feel like I can see both sides of this. At the same time, I feel like I'm someone who has never had opportunities nor money thrown at him, who people haven't noticed. I've been doing fine, thanks.
Right.
But I don't feel like there's ever been any buzz about me. And what is that quality? What is that thing? Who are these people that need to be talking about you? Because at the same time, I can see it from a more kind of Buddhist perspective of going, you know, that's where I'm trying to come from, is that there is no industry. There are no people talking about you. Name an act with buzz, and he or she is probably looking at the next person and going, why can't I have that? I mean, presumably on some level, Ricky Gervais is thinking, why can't I be this?
Yeah.
Why can't I get what that next guy has got, whoever that next person is? So I kind of, what I mean is I sort of completely empathise with that. But what is it? Does it exist?
I don't think so. And I hate to go back to... more and more in my life as a comic, I draw comfort and parallel from sports psychology.
That's lovely.
That's great.
But they coached athletes in only worrying about what they can affect. So the big example they always use is if you're a sprinter that runs badly in rain and you worry about it raining, then you can't control whether or not it rains, but you can control how good you are at running in the rain. So worry about what you can affect. I met a former Olympian and she said, oh, control the controllables, that's what they call that, control the control. So you can control how good your jokes are and how rested you are and, you know, to a certain extent how you look and if you're feeling happy for your show. But you can't really control whether or not somebody in an office is having a chat about you in a positive way and then trying to rubber stamp your career. Or maybe you can, but that's the bit of it that least interests me. I'm certainly not one of those comics that wakes up and thinks, oh, brilliant, I get to write a press release and send 300 emails to people that might give me an opportunity. I'm much more likely to think, oh, brilliant, I get to get up and think about funny stuff about that thing that happened yesterday when I was, you know, walking through the street. So I just think there's a certain amount of self-knowledge at work. I know that I'm not the guy that is knocking on people's doors going, hey, I've got this script so that you can make me a star. And so, you know, if I'm not asking them, what can I do? Just make sure that my jokes are all right, hopefully. And even then, there are some people that cannot see the jokes in what I do. You know, there are some people that see that, let's use that as my signature bit, the peach and Red Bull, and they just go, this is just a thing that happened to him on a train. I don't know why it's funny.
Sure.
And that's perfectly fine, I suppose. I personally think there's loads of funny bits in it, but, you know, I also think one of the things is trying to remind yourself of the sort of stand-up that you like and keep in mind that that stand-up has been approved, if you like. Like, I now sometimes go on YouTube and look at comics that I really like just to get it in my head that, hey, it doesn't all have to be gag, 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 gag. It can just be funny and sometimes a bit dry and droll, and sometimes it can be a bit underpowered. That's fine too, you know.
Reminds me of a wonderful line of yours I remember hearing years ago, when you say, if people aren't laughing at the moment, that's okay, because that's texture.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's wonderful. That's you. That's such a signature line.
Yeah, see, again, that is somewhat the folly of youth, because now I do think I'm less cocky about stuff like that. Maybe it's parenthood and, you know, responsibility. But I do think I'm much more inclined to just tell them the jokes and get moving on it these days. Not that I'm much faster tempo on telly. If I have to do stand-up for a recording, I try and stuff it with jokes, because my laconic delivery, which can seem a bit charming live, I think people just get a bit frustrated and think it's really baggy if they see it on telly. I just think they think, why is he taking this long? And I think that's why we've sort of got a generation, you know, like McIntyre or Russell or Jack Whitehall, who do jump about and really keep the gag content up high.
Yeah.
I wonder if they've all noticed that on telly it looks a bit slow.
Yeah,
I
wondered if that had something to do with, and I don't know in which order this might have happened, if it happened, but the way that Jimmy Carr became huge on TV, because he does a joke. If you're a producer and you want a 5 second joke, Jimmy can do you a joke that lasts 5 seconds.
Yeah.
If you want a 12 second joke, he's got hundreds of them as well.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether he knew that and aimed at that, or whether that was a happy coincidence of the type of jokes he liked to do.
Maybe.
That actually they're particularly useful on TV.
Yeah.
I wonder to what extent the maybe combative environment of somewhere like Mock the Week is affecting the sort of jokes that are created now, because all of these new people we were talking about, all of the guys that were pull up the ladder, as Henning said, you know, all these people who are starting it now, who are just hundreds of thousands of people doing stand up, they all started doing stand up in a world in which Mock the Week was what stand up is.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of your point, I'm now having a really morbid fantasy that there's hundreds of thousands of people starting stand-up.
Did I say off? Maybe I meant all, hundreds or thousands.
That seems too many.
Yeah.
Oh, please.
Sorry, that's trauma fantasy on my part.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, I don't know. I mean, it all comes in shifts, doesn't it, I suppose. I suppose now that there's more comedians, there's got to be more feeling invisible.
Definitely. This is it. I mean, I just wonder, what this is why I say there's no industry. What is there? This thing, there are so many people being brilliant, and there's not enough room for all of the people being brilliant to be known to be brilliant. And if you're someone that is brilliant and manages to make it and get famous and rich and stuff, that's great.
Yeah.
But equally, if you're someone who's brilliant who doesn't get that, how do you know that you're brilliant?
Yeah.
You just have to believe in yourself. I mean, we all need a huge amount of self-belief.
Just stay good and keep going.
Yeah.
No, seriously, that's it.
Yeah.
There was an article years ago that where they were interviewing Billy Connolly, and he said there was always room at the top. The middle and the bottom are overcrowded, aren't they? But there is always room at the top. That might be less true now that there's perhaps 50 people playing arenas.
Yeah.
Seems like, well, there can't be even that much room at the top anymore. Not that I think my quiet observations on life are that suitable for arenas.
What would you like to be doing? If you could have anything in the world of comedy, what do you want?
Do you know what? I really struggle with this, because what I wanted was to be a comedian. When, if you had told me, the 17-year-old me, you will not have a job, you will make money from being a comedian, I would have not even asked at what level. I wouldn't have said, what pub gigs? Or...
Sure.
Small scale touring, or are we talking arenas? You know, I would have just said, oh, really? Great. Excellent. I mean, I idolised comedians as a child, and still to a certain extent do. So I think all of that worrying about it is sort of worrying about scale, isn't it? It's just, you know, for me, being a comedian that gets to say what he wants and do gigs and receive some monies, obviously it becomes harder to worry about your artistic integrity versus your revenue, whatever. It'd be great to have the power of choice. You know, I really want to be mortgage free. That's the short answer. To be a mortgage free comedian, I think, would be just paradise. But no, I don't really worry about arenas versus 1,000 seaters or 200 seaters, or, you know, occasionally I feel a bit overlooked, but as we've discussed, I'm sure everyone does. And I'm sure there's also a bit of people feeling that they're going to get found out, and it's incredibly bipolar to feel overlooked and that you might get caught out. But I think that's the weird sort of slipstream that most comedians are operating in, you know.
I totally agree.
I mean, because it's all smoke and mirrors, isn't it? It's all talking out loud. But for me, the idea, the thing of it that was so attractive, was not having to have a life, like not having to have a job, just going, what, I can make a living by being me, or a version of me, and my experiences become like the content. That's, and now it's almost full circle, in that, like, originally it was, I don't have to do anything, and that makes up my art, if you like, all of that goes in. And now it's almost the other way, where you kind of force yourself to do things because you don't want to be one of those really self-indulged comedians that all their material is about hotels and trains and dressing rooms. And there's a sort of a thing of forcing yourself to have a life, isn't there? Going, I need a day off, and I want to, you know, have a family and do normal things and be a person, which I now really like. You know, if you told the teenage me that I would be the kind of man who happily talks about how many miles to the gallon a car will get, I would have been horrified.
We do happily talk about those things.
Yeah. But in a weird way, that I find that quite inclusive as well, because you know, actually, I felt such an outsider growing up that doing inclusive... I have a theory that the observational comics that are saying, hey, why do we all do this? I think they started as the biggest outsiders and they love this inclusion of going, oh, we all eat a peach over the sink, don't we? Mm. You guys are just like me. And I think they're the ones that were in the corner of the playground thinking, why am I so different? You know, I think, you know, I personally felt like that, but I had a slightly weird upbringing and it was very... I moved about a lot, so I started lots of new schools.
Okay.
And I had, you know, points of difference, like a Scottish accent in English schools, and mm-hmm. my dad had died and the other pupils knew that. So there was lots of things that made me feel different. And now, I suppose, feeling like I can join, even if it's with businessmen talking about what miles to the gallon their fucking Vauxhall Vectra gets, there's still a bit of me that thinks, oh, this is sort of, you know, togetherness. I'm like a normal guy here for a split second.
I'm fascinated by that idea of whether the comedian as a person is an outsider or an insider.
I think we're outsiders looking in. I really do. I think, and even to the point where I was speaking to somebody the other day and they said, oh wow, you must have so much free time. And you think, yeah, it sounds like that when you're a teenager. You're like, oh yeah, you'll only work at night time. And you think, great, I'll hang out with my mates all day. And you go, no, that's when your mates will be working. And when they get home, you'll be getting in the car to go somewhere. That's how it is. You know, we're upside down. There was times in the past where I'd not really spoken until arriving at a gig that night. And you used to think, you spend all day on your own. And then you tell your thoughts to 400 people. And then sometimes you're out the door and on a tube, not speaking to people with your headphones on or whatever. And you think, this is a bit weird and imbalanced, isn't it? It's not... There is a bit upside down, isn't it? There is a definite upside down topsy-turviness to it as a lifestyle that I think is probably quite sensible to try and arrest as much as possible.
So you try to have as much of a normal life as you can?
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel particularly normal, but I also feel like I have a sense of normality. Like, I quite like it when I get reviewed as down-to-earth comedian, which I am.
Yeah.
Because all my school reports were head in the clouds, idiot, daydreamer, doesn't work hard enough, you know, and I was probably that kid that was just looking out the window and not listening and having silly daydreams. So I quite like it now that I've kind of grounded myself to become a normal comic.
Something I've been asking people to do, or occasionally when I remember, is
try to take my jeans off.
If you yes, come on, is to look at something you're working on at the moment, and sort of explain what you're gonna, what the next step is with it. Have you got like a notebook on you? Have you got a thing or an idea?
Yeah, but your microphone's balanced on it. This could
be interesting. All right.
Okay.
I think it'd be quite interesting to sort of look at the words as they are now and then explore what's going to happen with them next.
I actually had the set list for tomorrow night's thing on it. Oh, there we go. Improvements. Spoiler.
Spoiler, go on.
I've written the word improvements-spoiler, and that's because it struck me as I was driving the other day that it's ironic that people that put spoilers on their cars are trying to improve them. And yet it couldn't be clearer, could it? It's called a spoiler.
And it ruins your car.
It's a spoiler off cars. So that's just, I mean, that's, I've written it down like two words, improvement, spoiler.
Okay, but so the next thing you'll do is go and talk around that subject.
Possibly, yeah. Or possibly I'll disregard it and think this is shit. but maybe what might happen is I could try it at a new material night, think it's awful, and then in 3 years' time I might be doing some other material about cars and think, oh, there was that spoiler thing, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And also I have a thing at the moment where if I'm driving and there's people in the car and we go past the car with a spoiler, I will mutter, spoiler alert. and so, like, it could be that the improvements that are actually spoiling things could then become, like, a bit about spoilers, which could then become people that get their houses stone cladded is another thing that they spend money on trying to improve their house, and actually it spoils it. So it could be, it could become a bit that's...
So then the bit is spoiler alert, and it's all the things that people do that spoil things.
So, I mean, I've talked to Mickey about this quite a bit as well, that that I'm kind of attracted to bits that are clumps of jokes together. So you would sort of cluster spoiler alert and spoilers, and so it's the power of the monologue, isn't it? I'm not a one-liner guy. I'm a guy who has little bits that's like, hey, these are my thoughts on this chunk of thing. See, that's the process, really. It's, it begins with a scribble, or sometimes it begins with a text message, or it might even be in my notes in my phone. I'll see if I've got some that are sort of typical of what my things that I would write down are. Oh, there we go. I've got in my notes in my phone, squishy face and a woman in the street who walked like she had wet hands. That the squishy face is an old bit of material.
I've heard you do the squishy face.
That
bit,
I used to do. That, again, happened to me in the street. I walked past somebody who had a squished up face and I thought, oh, some people have got squished up faces. I could talk about that. But then the other day, I literally saw somebody who walked as if
As if they were flicking water off their hands.
It was just a weird walk. But you know, sometimes people hold their hands slightly higher if they're wet. And that could be the beginning of a routine for me. Like, that could be... It could be the beginning of a routine in a bathroom, or it could be the beginning of a routine about how people walk differently. I don't know what it'll be yet, but that's the genesis
of
it.
Do you have sort of normal routes that you would take? Do you kind of try and... Say a route that you could take on that might be to go, okay, why have they done that? Like, to interrogate, why is someone doing that? What is another reason? What's a true reason they might be doing that? What's a false reason they might be doing that? Or do you kind of... I don't know. I suppose what I'm asking is, do you have certain strategies, like take an idea and turn it upside down?
Cynical and awful.
No, it
wouldn't. Like going, hey, what... Who's a celebrity that everybody has a go at? Lindsay Lohan. I mean, you know, these people that just churn out jokes things that are meant to be funny.
I think
it's the antithesis of that.
I think it's entirely possible to have a strategy without it being like that. Like, a strategy might be something that we've discussed in the past, which is, when comparing, asking provocative questions of the audience.
Right.
That then let them say something surprising.
Oh, okay.
I mean, like, that might be a strategy rather than just coming and going, so give us a cheer if you've... Like, you know, that's a lazy strategy. There are lazy ones and there are less lazy ones.
Yeah. No, you'd think I'd have a system by now. But I'm not really a systems person. It's slightly more... I mean, it might come to nothing, or it might be my next big bit. Look out for... have you seen Alan Cochrane's wet hands bit?
The wet hands stuff.
The wet hands thing. But as it happens, I have a big bit at the moment that is about how we slightly judge each other on what we drink, like tea and coffee, and people that get red wine stains on their mouth and stuff. So it's quite a long, layered bit. But I believe that started with a bit that has now completely fallen away from the routine, when I met a builder who had three sugars in his tea. And I remember thinking, oh, I haven't met somebody that has three for ages. and feeling a bit middle class about it. Oh, three? Oh, how ghastly, you know. And when I started doing it, it was about sugar in tea. And then it kind of moved along, and I dropped the bit about build. I used to do a thing where it was weird that it seems strange that you would take it from a manual labourer, wouldn't you? You'd take them having three sugars. But if you were meeting an expensive solicitor and you went in and they went, Janet, can I have a tea with three, please? You'd think, you're not a lawyer.
You're not a real solicitor.
You're a builder that's put a suit on. Stop ripping me off. And yet it was weird, because that... I don't know, maybe it's... I think it's fine and I quite like it, but it probably just fell away because it wasn't being funny enough, or perhaps some rougher gigs thought that I was being a middle class snob, which I find weird because I don't feel middle class, but I can see how people could perceive me as middle class because I'm talking about the minutiae. So, you know, it probably seems quite a comfortable upbringing that has led to someone discussing pizza toppings and peaches and kids and car MPGs or whatever, you know, tea and coffee. But that that sort of thing happens quite often to me, where it'll fall away and then someone will say, oh, are you still doing that bit about the sugar in tea? And I'll go, no, I'm not. And they'll go, oh, I really liked that when I saw you do it. And I always feel like, oh, you mean I've kept the shit bit? Oh, again!
you mentioned Mickey earlier on.
Michael Flanagan.
Michael Flanagan Mickey. Esquire. When I first met you and you assumed that kind of, in my eyes, that kind of mentor role,
yeah.
I assumed that Mickey had a similar role with you. Is that right? Is that sort of case? I mean, he's been going a bit longer than you.
Yeah, he's definitely.
You were mates with him outside of gigs.
We're mates. We did the Big Value comedy show
that was it,
2001. And our social paths crossed. He moved to the area of London that I was living in with his girlfriend, now wife, and then our wives and you know, our friends became friends with each other, I suppose. So yeah, he has that, and I've always really liked what he does.
I just wonder if there's, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you again.
No,
I think, you're going to say what I'm going to say. I think there's parallels between how he works and how you work.
Yeah, I think we both like people being funny about their lives, you know. I think it's all kind of life experience going in and then being turned into jokes. But I imagine Mickey, you know, if you said to him, okay, I want 10 jokes about Lindsay Lohan, I imagine he'd be depressed and sullen about it. But I think he's more than capable of writing 10 jokes. It's just that it's not that interesting to him, because he would rather be, you know, a really funny man about life. And that's the sort of stand-up that I'm drawn to. Maybe that's why the one-liners guy, I sometimes just tune out a bit. Much though I like it for a short while, there is a bit of it that is like a parlour game, isn't it? It's like,
sure,
there is a point where you go, oh, okay, so now I know that you can put loads of conflicting sentences together.
Yes.
Okay, you could have equally done a cigar box routine for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm sorry I haven't a clue for myself. By the first time I got an iPod, I downloaded all of I'm sorry I haven't a clue.
Really?
And then it just came on random in the car. And by the time you just hear it over and over again.
Yeah.
Not Hump's amazing introductory bits, which are just timeless.
Absolutely,
brilliant.
Yeah.
But all of the stuff, it was kind of, and brilliant jokes that everyone, Barry and everyone else, was coming out with.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I listen to far too much of it,
yeah,
and you end up not knowing. It becomes frustrating. Like, there's another idea smashed together, and another idea smashed together. It's like watching. It started to feel like watching bad performance art, where they've gone, it's a pair of shoes full of milk, which represents anything. It's a sewing machine made of jelly, which could mean anything. You know, it's like.
Is that familiarity breeds contempt, though? You just OD'd on it. And
yeah, well, that's it. You're probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just don't listen to any for ages and come back as a
Yeah,
fan.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the tactic. But yeah, I mean, it sounds really self-important, but this is the place for it. Is that, you know, at my most self-indulgent, I do think I really like stand-up that is a way of processing life. Like, I really like it when people are trying to figure it out. And like, I have a bit at the moment that I thought, I mean, at its worst, it's probably what Jeremy Clarkson does in those twatty books of, you know, how did it end up like this? and that I'm not especially pleased
the
by.
Thinking man's Jeremy Clarkson.
But at its best, I really like material that is, this is how we exist. Is it not silly and absurd? And I have a bit about there being a TV advert for an air freshener that has 6 different smell settings, and one of them is open window.
That's not real.
It is real.
Is it real?
Yeah,
oh my God.
Real. But it's one of those ones where you go, you know, the whole population could watch that advert and never think that is weird. Like, that's the point where, like, I become a comedian by going, what are the other settings on it? Like, potpourri and, like, smelly fart? Or, you know, there's a way of going, well, I've added, I've seen that, and that's been the taper lit, but then I've been the explosion.
Like,
if I could get more violent imagery, I'd be impressed.
I love it. Alan, I am the explosion. Cochrane, there we go. Show title sorted, 2013.
Yeah. But I do... At my most self-indulgent, I do think I like stand-up that is about life. You know, I'm not one that's particularly bothered if people want to talk about, you know, I don't mind some surreal humour, but one of the problems now, of course, is that we get a sort of a knee-jerk version of surreal, don't we? We don't get what surreal is meant to be, which is the super real, isn't it? So it's sort of realism to the point of it being slightly frightening and strange and absurd. But actually what we get is some cunt in jeans talking about squirrels.
Right, there we go. An hour in, we're finally getting to the real stuff.
No, but that's what, you know, I wouldn't mind if surreal comedy was about that, but, you know, some of them are less so, let's say.
How do you relate to the comedy community? To other comedians, do you feel you've got a place in it? Do you feel what are your feelings about?
I imagine they're all gathered right now, wondering why I'm invisible. No, I feel like I have a place in it. I genuinely and sincerely think it is a privilege that by being a comedian, if you're any good, you end up with some fucking funny friends. I think that's one of the joys of it. It's like, you know, if I look through my iPhone, there's some really funny people in there, and that probably wouldn't happen if I was a drama teacher or you know, if I was a hod carrier, then it might, but it might not equally. I think sometimes, like, people with real work stories, they've only got really a good 10 minutes and then then they're out, aren't they?
Do you ever feel like there is any danger that you might run out of funny?
Yes and no.
Go on.
I think it's slightly undulating, one's self-confidence in one's funniness, you know. I mean, I hate it in a way when I absolutely smash a gig that I sometimes think, oh God, you probably don't get that many of those absolute smashers. It would be really handy if that had come along at a gig that was rammed with industry.
And you might have, what is the thing that you've used up that go?
Yeah, I've used up. Like, you know, if you only got like 20 in your life that were absolute, like, double A barnstormers, like, I'm not sure if I have, I might not have used any of my 20. But yeah, I suppose I think I have a pretty good gauge of where I am in the food chain, and actually I think I've got, people sometimes say I'm a bit harsh on myself after gigs, but I think I've got a pretty good gauge of how well I think I've done. You know, I'm not one of those acts that has done 6 out of 10 and thinks it's a 9. And nor, I don't think, am I one of those acts that's done a 9 and thinks it's a 4, because they're a fucking pain to be around as well. But I think I would really worry if I thought my gauge was going, you know, if I became one of those old comics that's a bit punch drunk and thinks they're having stormers when actually they're coping.
Yeah.
That I shudder about that. That would make me paranoid. But I think actually the way of not being like that is to constantly refresh your stuff so that you know what old stuff doing well sounds like, and new stuff doing well, and new stuff doing badly, and old stuff doing. As long as you keep hearing the sounds of what different bits of the palette do, I think you're probably all right.
In your 20 at the moment, I mean, do you have a 20 at the moment? Are you sort of...
That's interesting. I've never been a comic that has a very strict 20. I usually know what I'll go off on, roughly. Or usually, if I go on to do a 20... I did 3 20s last weekend, so this is quite a good time to ask me this. Usually, I will have 1 or 2 different reasonably big routines that could be the closing bit. But at the moment, because I'm not doing tons and tons of club stand-up, sometimes a crowd-pleasing 20 is the bit that I don't have. You know, sometimes I can do a week where I do a Radio 4 show, a corporate event, an hour-long tour show, or more than an hour, and then Frank's radio show on Saturday mornings, and then I'm suddenly in a 20-minute gig, and I'm not ring rusty. I've done five other things that week.
Yeah.
But suddenly I'm in front of people that weekendy out.
Yeah.
The kind of people that respond to different things. And sometimes it would be really handy to have a 20 that I just knew off by heart and here's the stuff and I'm done. But I'm much more fluid about it. I will find myself going into routines just because they're coming out of my mouth, you know. What would you like to know about my supposed circuit 20?
What I was going to ask was, how much of it is from which of your previous hours? Like, how old is it? And it, does it... Obviously, it sort of changes from gig to gig. But I think what I'm getting at is I sometimes feel that the Edinburgh system is really screwed up.
Yes.
Because you spend a year writing a show for Edinburgh, and then after Edinburgh, you don't work on those bits necessary. I don't work on those bits necessarily because I regard them as finished. I can't do them at Edinburgh again, so they're a waste of time to do in part of the long run-up process.
I totally agree. Now, I didn't used to. I totally agree with you. And I did three sets on the weekend. I used stuff from the last show I did, but also because I'm doing this telly thing tomorrow night, in two of them I went back perhaps a year or 2 years to some baby stuff that I used to do because I was dusting it off and adding a few jokes. So that probably the oldest stuff in it would have been 3 years. In fact, maybe even more. There might have been, because I now sometimes open with a joke about living in Manchester, and that's a weird thing because I used to do it when I was visiting Manchester about if you get drunk with Mancunians, one of them turns into a donkey. They come back from the round, they buy a round and they come back and give you a beer and they go,
yeah.
It's a really naff little, like, I thought it was a bit of local, and then I ended up with it in a story about Manchester that I was doing at the time, and it became like a banker within the story. And then I started moving it to the start because I realised that I could do it at the start, say it's a naff joke, and then I could do a thing that's more about me. In fact, I do that open window thing after it sometimes where I say, oh, I prefer stand-ups about life, like what have we done to the world? And so there's three or four what have we done to the world things. But that's quite old. But I sometimes think you don't have to chuck the baby out with the bathwater. If a bit's old and works, you can keep it. And I'm not one of those comics that's got really old stuff. But I... In a 20-minute on the circuit, I think it's fine to do stuff that's going to work. You know, you don't sort of get any prizes for dying, especially not if I'm not going up to Edinburgh. There's no sort of big, arty woo-hoo.
Yeah.
I'm slightly different in corporate environment because they've written a cheque and you definitely don't get prizes for dying. There's no... Art is not a part of it. Effectiveness is the big part of it. So in that environment, I have a much shallower pool of material, but it's much more dependable and accessible. And it is older, some of it. And because I've been doing it a while, it's gag heavy, and I like it. I really like doing it. I love going, oh, well, these jokes will probably work.
That's it.
It's a really nice feeling.
It's trying to get back to doing stand-up in order to make people laugh, as opposed to doing stand-up in order to practice a bit for another thing that's part of something else. I wonder sometimes if I haven't got it all, like if I'm training myself into that thing of I have to do an Edinburgh hour every year. And actually, if I didn't go up to that festival at all, I wonder how different I would be as a comic.
Yeah,
I mean, it's good to be stretched in all those different ways, but at the same time, I think next year I'm going to have a year off.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the process as well, to go, it's not just about, you know, maybe we should be writing set lists based on, or scribbling or whatever, a set list based on topics. You know, you were saying you had a bit about babies.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I shouldn't be going, this bit's 4 years old, that bit's 1 year old, this bit's not ready yet.
No.
Do you know what I mean? So much as going, what do I want to talk about to these people?
Yeah, I think so. But it's a false ending, isn't it? It's a weird false ending. There's a lot about Edinburgh that isn't quite right, but, you know, you and I can't change it this afternoon. Like an hour, I don't think, is quite right
for
a person on their own. I think 45-minute shows or an hour and 20 shows might be more applicable, but it's just weird. I don't think... I don't think we're going to fix it though. But I do have, I mean, the worst gig of the three that I did over the weekend was the last one, and unbeknown to me, the double up that I was doing, I went on first in Leicester and had a great time, and in Nottingham I didn't realise that the double up was tight and the Leicester show had started late. So by the time I got there, the audience had had an hour long interval.
Whoa.
And I was on last.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because it was that smudge start that you see every now and again on stand-up stages, where I kind of went, hello, I've travelled from Manchester this weekend to do gigs, and someone cheered and I went, oh, have we got a Mancunian in over there? And they didn't answer, and I could feel this pissed audience that had waited for me for an hour thinking, what's this? Like, yeah. And nothing had happened yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe that was the problem, that nothing had happened yet, but there was still so much chatter that for anything to happen would have been kind of chucking it away. Like, you kind of need focus before you do anything in those rough rooms sometimes. And it wasn't a bun fight, but it was just a lot of really pissed people and me shouting some stuff at them. It felt like, that's how I feel when gigs are a bit pressurised. I feel like, oh, I'm shouting my best gear at you and moving on, so it sort of becomes like buh, 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 buh. So that one I went back to some older stuff and then back forward again to some stuff that I wanted to dust off, and so it was all a bit higgledy piggledy, which is possibly my fault. But I think it is, when I tour I have a much more organised set list. Like in Edinburgh shows and touring shows, I fire it out pretty much in an order, with moments of chat as well, but I don't start doing a bit because it pops into my head at that point like I would with a 20. Does that answer the question? It feels like an incredibly boring answer.
I don't think so. I think the geeky comedy nerd listenership of this podcast will regard that as fascinating.
Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, I usually have two or three chunky big bits that could be the second half of a 20, so...
I always remember you telling me at Edinburgh, whenever we've talked about the last couple of years, whenever we've talked about how the readiness of our Edinburgh shows.
Oh yeah,
you're very fond of saying it can always do with three more good bits.
Everybody, yeah, every comic I know could do with three more good big bits. And I don't mean like that I think they're shit and they need three more big bits. I imagine
all of us are constantly thinking it's always the answer to the question, how are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. But that's part of it, isn't it? It's one of the things that I find actually quite enlightening about it. Like, I love the fact that I don't do Sudoku, like, because I have this constant puzzle to work on, which is stand-up comedy. Like, there's no point in me sitting on a train with a pen and doing a Sudoku, because I get all those fucking buzzes from going, oh, that thing that I used to do about that never really worked, I could bolt that onto that new bit about Tony Blair, and then I would have a Tony Blair pizza routine. That'll be the best thing ever. You know what I mean? So it's sort of, you know, people say, what have you been doing? And I can say, I've done nothing, but actually I've sat and really... So I just really like the fact that hopefully I'll always need three more big bits the rest of my life. That would be great. In a weird way, when you say, what do you actually want from your career? In an odd way, I want to keep going and constantly have to puzzle out this fucking conundrum that is stand-up comedy.
So that was Alan. The ending was a little bit abrupt there. Sorry about that. The proper goodbye is on the extra content. There's another 25 minutes or so of my conversation with Alan, which includes us talking about how deaths on stage are part of the process. Alan's challenge, he challenged himself to write a show made out of one-liners, and that was a very interesting journey. I'm sorry I didn't have time to put it on the main show, but I'm trying to keep them to an hour. So Alan talking about one-liners and his problems with them, with writing, with performing with them, and the, I should say challenges rather than problems, but I think he would say problems. But that's very, very interesting to hear someone go totally against the grain of their experience and really push themselves. There's a wonderful quote on what Alan considers to be the problem with observational comedy. And we also discussed the importance of always needing three more good bits. That can all be found at comedianscomedian.com/Alan, which of course is spelt as Alan's spelling. That's A-L-U-N. A-L-U-N. So comedianscomedian.com/Alan, A-L-U-N, for all the extra stuff. Thank you very much, as ever, to Two Entertain, Dan Melrose for the music, Graham Crockford for help with the sound and web nerd stuff. Have a wonderful summer. Hopefully you'll hear from Liam Malone in a fortnight. And if you're going to Edinburgh, have a fantastic time. If you're not, you bastards, enjoy it.